Chapter 9. I think so, yes, but I don't remember.
Q. Well, that is the most extraordinary statement I ever heard.
A. Why, what makes you think that?
Q. How could I think otherwise?
Why, look here. Who is this a picture of on the wall? Isn't that a brother of yours?
A. Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Now you remind me of it. That was a brother of mine. That's William Bill, we called him.
Poor old Bill.
Q. Why? Is he dead, then? Well, I suppose so. We never could tell. There was a great mystery about it.
Q. That is sad, very sad.
He disappeared, then?
Well, yes, in a sort of general way.
We buried him.
Q. Buried him?
Buried him, without knowing whether he was dead or not.
No.
Not that. He was dead enough.
Q. Well, I confess that I can't understand this.
If you buried him, and you knew he was dead,
No.
No.
We only thought he was.
Q. Oh, I see. He came to life again?
I bet he didn't.
Q. Well, I never heard anything like this. Somebody was dead. Somebody was buried.
Now, where was the mystery?
That's just it.
That's it exactly.
You see, we were twins, defunct, and we got mixed in the bathtub when we were only 2 weeks old, and one of us was drowned. But we didn't know which.
Some think it was Bill. Some think it was me.
Q. Well, that is remarkable.
What do you think?
Goodness knows. I would give whole worlds to know.
This solemn, this awful mystery has cast a gloom over my whole life.
But I will tell you a secret now, which I never have revealed to any creature before.
One of us had a peculiar mark, a large mole on the back of his left hand.
That was me.
That child was the one that was drowned.
Q. Very well, then. I don't see that there is any mystery about it, after all.
You don't?
Well, I do. Anyway, I don't see how they could ever have been such a blundering lot as to go and bury the wrong child.
But, don't mention it where the family can hear of it.
Heaven knows they have heartbreaking troubles enough without adding this.
Q. Well, I believe I have got material enough for the present, and I am very much obliged to you for the pains you have taken.
But I was a good deal interested in that account of Aaron Burr's funeral.
Would you mind telling me what particular circumstance it was that made you think Burr was such a remarkable man?
It was a mere trifle. Not one man in 50 would have noticed it at all.
When the sermon was over, and the procession all ready to start for the cemetery, and the body all arranged nice in the hearse, he said he wanted to take a last look at the scenery, and so he got up and rode with the driver.
Then the young man reverently withdrew.
He was very pleasant company, and I was sorry to see him go.
Paris notes, crowded out of, tram bay broad to make room for more vital statistics.
M. T. The Parisian travels but little, he knows no language but his own, reads no literature but his own, and consequently he is pretty narrow and pretty self-sufficient. However, let us not be too sweeping. There are Frenchmen who know languages not their own. These are the waiters. Among the rest, they know English. That is, they know it on the European plan, which is to say, they can speak it, but can't understand it. They easily make themselves understood, but it is next to impossible to word an English sentence in such a way as to enable them to comprehend it. They think they comprehend it. They pretend they do, but they don't. Here is a conversation which I had with one of these beings. I wrote it down at the time, in order to have it exactly correct.
These are fine oranges.
Where are they grown?
He.
More?
Yes, I will bring them.
I. No, do not bring any more. I only want to know where they are from where they are raised.
He.
Yes?
With imperturbable mien and rising inflection.
Yes. Can you tell me what country they are from?
He.
Yes?
Blandly, with rising inflection.
Disheartened. They are very nice.
He.
Good night.
bows, and retires, quite satisfied with himself.
That young man could have become a good English scholar by taking the right sort of pains, but he was French, and wouldn't do that. How different is the case with our people? They utilize every means that offers. There are some alleged French Protestants in Paris, and they built a nice little church on one of the great avenues that lead away from the Arch of Triumph, and proposed to listen to the correct thing, preached in the correct way, there, in their precious French tongue, and be happy. But their little game does not succeed. Our people are always there ahead of them Sundays, and take up all the room. When the minister gets up to preach, he finds his house full of devout foreigners, each ready and waiting, with his little book in his hand, a Morocco-bound testament, apparently. But only apparently. It is Mr. Bellow's admirable and exhaustive little French-English dictionary, which in look and binding and size is just like a testament, and those people are there to study French. The building has been nicknamed the Church of the Gratis French Lesson. These students probably acquire more language than general information, for I am told that a French sermon is like a French speech. It never names a historical event, but only the date of it. If you are not up in dates, you get left. A French speech is something like this. Comrades, citizens, brothers, noble parts of the only sublime and perfect nation, let us not forget that the 21st January cast off our chains, that the 10th August relieved us of the shameful presence of foreign spies, that the 5th September was its own justification before heaven and humanity, that the 18th Brumaire contained the seeds of its own punishment, that the 14th July was the mighty voice of liberty proclaiming the resurrection, the new day, and inviting the oppressed peoples of the earth to look upon the divine face of France and live. And let us here record our everlasting curse against the man of the 2d December, and declare in thunder tones, the native tones of France, that but for him there had been no 17th March in history, no 12th October, no 19th January, no 22d April, no 16th November, no 30th September, no 2d July, no 14th February, no 29th June, no 15th August, no 31st May, that but for him, France the pure, the grand, the peerless, had had a serene and vacant almanac today. I have heard of one French sermon which closed in this odd yet eloquent way. My hearers, we have sad cause to remember the man of the 13th January. The results of the vast crime of the 13th January have been in just proportion to the magnitude of the set itself. But for it there had been no 30 November sorrowful spectacle. The grisly deed of the 16th June had not been done but for it, nor had the man of the 16th June known existence. To it alone the 3d September was due, also the fatal 12th October. Shall we, then, be grateful for the 13th January, with its freight of death for you and me, and all that breathe? Yes, my friends, for it gave us also that which had never come but for it, and it atoned the blessed 25th December. It may be well enough to explain, though in the case of many of my readers this will hardly be necessary. The man of the 13th January is Adam. The crime of that date was the eating of the apple. The sorrowful spectacle of the 30th November was the expulsion from Eden. The grisly deed of the 16th June was the murder of Abel. The act of the 3d September was the beginning of the journey to the land of Nod. The 12th day of October, the last mountaintops disappeared under the flood. When you go to church in France, you want to take your almanac with you annotated. Legend of Sagenfeld, in Germany, left out of Tramp Abroad, because its authenticity seemed doubtful, and could not at that time be proved. M.T. More than 1,000 years ago this small district was a kingdom, a little bit of a kingdom, a sort of dainty little toy kingdom, as one might say. It was far removed from the jealousies, strifes, and turmoils of that old warlike day, and so its life was a simple life, its people a gentle and guileless race. It lay always in a deep dream of peace, a soft Sabbath tranquility, There was no malice, there was no envy, there was no ambition. Consequently, there were no heart burnings, there was no unhappiness in the land. In the course of time, the old king died, and his little son Hubert came to the throne. The people's love for him grew daily. He was so good, and so pure and so noble, that by and by his love became a passion, almost a worship. Now at his birth the soothsayers had diligently studied the stars, and found something written in that shining book to this effect. In Hubert's 14th year a pregnant event will happen. The animal whose singing shall sound sweetest in Hubert's ear shall save Hubert's life. So long as the king and the nation shall honor this animal's race for this good deed, the ancient dynasty shall not fail of an heir, nor the nation know war, pestilence, or poverty. But beware an erring choice. All through the king's 13th year, but one thing was talked of by the soothsayers, the statesmen, the little parliament, and the general people. That one thing was this. How is the last sentence of the prophecy to be understood? What goes before seems to mean that the saving animal will choose itself at the proper time, but the closing sentence seems to mean that the king must choose beforehand, and say what singer among the animals pleases him best, and that if he choose wisely the chosen animal will save his life, his dynasty, his people, but that if he should make an erring choice, beware. By the end of the year there were as many opinions about this matter as there had been in the beginning, but a majority of the wise and the simple were agreed that the safest plan would be for the little king to make choice beforehand, and the earlier the better. So an edict was sent forth commanding all persons who owned singing creatures to bring them to the great hall of the palace in the morning of the first day of the new year. This command was obeyed. When everything was in readiness for the trial, the king made a solemn entry with the great officers of the crown, all clothed in their robes of state. The king mounted his golden throne and prepared to give judgment. But he presently said, "These creatures all sing at once. The noise is unendurable. No one can choose in such a turmoil. Take them all away, and bring back one at a time." This was done. One sweet warbler after another charmed the young king's ear, and was removed to make way for another candidate. The precious minutes slipped by. Among so many bewitching songsters he found it hard to choose, and all the harder, because the promised penalty for an error was so terrible that it unsettled his judgment, and made him afraid to trust his own ears. He grew nervous and his face showed distress. His ministers saw this, for they never took their eyes from him a moment. Now they began to say in their hearts, "He has lost courage, the cool head is gone, he will err, he, and his dynasty and his people are doomed." At the end of an hour the king sat silent a while, and then said, "Bring back the linnet." The linnet trilled forth her jubilant music. In the midst of it the king was about to uplift his scepter in sign of choice, but checked himself and said, "But let us be sure. Bring back the thrush, let them sing together." The thrush was brought, and the two birds poured out their marvels of song together. The king wavered, then his inclination began to settle and strengthen, one could see it in his countenance. Hope budded in the hearts of the old ministers, their pulses began to beat quicker, the scepter began to rise slowly, when there was a hideous interruption. It was a sound like this, just at the door. "Wow. Dot dot e. Wow dot 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 e. Wow e. Wow e. Dash dash wow e." Everybody was sorely startled and enraged at himself for showing it. The next instant the dearest, sweetest, prettiest little peasant maid of 9 years came tripping in, her brown eyes glowing with childish eagerness. But when she saw that august company, and those angry faces, she stopped and hung her head, and put her poor coarse apron to her eyes. Nobody gave her welcome, none pitied her. Presently she looked up timidly through her tears, and said, "My lord the king, I pray you pardon me, for I meant no wrong. I have no father and no mother, but I have a goat and a donkey, and they are all in all to me. My goat gives me the sweetest milk, and when my dear good donkey brays it seems to me there is no music like to it.
So when my lord the king's jester said the sweetest singer among all the animals should save the crown and nation, and moved me to bring him here, all the court burst into a rude laugh, and the child fled away crying, without trying to finish her speech. The chief minister gave a private order that she and her disastrous donkey be flogged beyond the precincts of the palace, and commanded to come within them no more. Then the trial of the birds was resumed. The two birds sang their best, but the scepter lay motionless in the king's hand. Hope died slowly out in the breasts of all. An hour went by, 2 hours, still no decision. The day waned to its close, and the waiting multitudes outside the palace grew crazed with anxiety and apprehension. The twilight came on, the shadows fell deeper and deeper. The king and his court could no longer see each other's faces. No one spoke, none called for lights. The great trial had been made. It had failed. Each and all wished to hide their faces from the light, and cover up their deep trouble in their own hearts. Finally, hark! A rich, full strain of the divinest melody streamed forth from a remote part of the hall, the nightingale's voice. Up! Shouted the king, let all the bells make proclamation to the people, for the choice is made, and we have not erred. King, Dynasty. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.